I'm continuing, obviously, towards the climax, in which I'm going to try and say something about the face of God. But I may not be able to encompass that quite, because after all, it's something about which one can't produce concrete images. But today is a sort of digression concerning something about which we have perhaps too many concrete images, which is our own environment. But since it's such an important topic, I think it might be useful as a way of introducing the really difficult topic to follow. So here you see, of course, a once sacred place, now ruined by an adjacent motorway. I was saying a lot about the sacrileges that we commit, often unknowingly, towards such things. In his encounter with Moses, which I began from in the first lecture, in his encounter with Moses, God makes three things clear to his people. First, he is a person. Secondly, there is a body of rules and covenants by which we can live in peace with him. Thirdly, we must make room for him among us by building a temple as his home. In this lecture, I want to turn my attention to the third of those declarations. In studying the human face last Thursday, I was exploring some part of what it means to say that persons reveal themselves in the world. The real presence of the person brings the search for righteousness and the possibility of guilt, since it means that we live under the eyes of strangers and are judged by them. And when we seek refuge in intimacy so as to look into eyes that look into ours, we are confronted with a peculiar moral barrier. Eros is not a place of ordinary safety, but a sanctuary, a precinct threatened by pollution and protected by taboo. The temptation is to enter this place in a spirit of iconoclasm, destroying or masking the face. And that is the familiar path of desecration, which brings neither peace nor love. For love is a relation between subjects, and when people become objects for each other, love withers and dies. The result of this defacing of the erotic is not hatred, but an ever-expanding heartlessness. The destiny of Eros in our time reminds us of the many other ways in which we seek the guiltless place, the place free from adverse judgment. In the Torah, God's gift of laws and covenants is the path to that place. It guides us in the way of the Lord. But law in the Hebrew Bible does not stand alone, nor are God's commandments offered as though arbitrary and absolute, and without foundation in the personal relations that God upholds and claims. On the contrary, the law is connected from the outset with the concept of neighbour love, the love that St. Paul calls agape, and which, to use Kant's idiom, can be willed as a law. Hence, the law of the Torah is not an unexplained path. It is not the record of God's arbitrary will for which he is not accountable. Maybe the Sharia is such an unexplained path for the Asharite exponents of the Quran. But the law of the Torah is entirely bound up with God's identity as a person. Through the law, God is putting relations with his creatures on an interpersonal footing and making clear that this is, in the end, the righteous life, the life free from guilt, in which we are at one with each other and with our own being in the world. This life, the redeemed life, is one of reciprocal love in which God is bound to each of us by mutual promises and vows. All that, I think, must be borne in mind as we turn to God's third declaration that he requires a home in this world, a temple in which the architecture and the rituals convey a clear conception of his nature and his presence. It is one of the striking features of the Old Testament narrative that it makes frequent reference to sacred places. The patriarchs are constantly erecting altars, making sacrifices, bestowing names on places rendered holy by some encounter with God and his angels. The narrative of the sacred place begins with Moses and the burning bush and proceeds to the flight from Egypt to the promised land. Although that land is already occupied, the implication is that its tenants have lost the right to it because they have not seen it as a gift from God. The idea that certain places are sacred seems to be a human universal, as we see from that, these two famous examples. Different accounts are given to explain the idea. For some cultures, gods, spirits, and other supernatural agents live among us and must be worshipped and acknowledged at the spot where they reside. For others, a place becomes sacred because it is the haunt of a ghost, maybe the ghost of someone who has died with some deep need unsatisfied or some deep love denied, and whose moments of crisis occurred at this very spot. That idea you find in the Shinto religion and dramatized beautifully in the No Theatre of Japan. Other cultures connect sacred places with the legends of heroes or with great battles of the past to which we come to pay respects for some patriotic sacrifice. Of course, the American Civil War has left a lot of such sacred places scattered around Virginia. In all cultures where dead people are ceremonially buried, the place of burial becomes hallowed ground, and ritualized acts and words are deemed appropriate when we walk there. Civilization involves a collective attempt to endow death with a meaning. Funerary rites, beliefs about the gods and the afterlife, invocations of ancestors, and declarations of solidarity with the dead and the unborn. These are the core experiences from which lasting cultures derive, and they find expression in graveyards and tombs at every age and in every place. In a fascinating and thoughtful book, Ken Walpole has recorded the astonishing variety of attempts to render death acceptable after the event through the architecture, landscaping, and rituals of the cemetery. This is one of Ken Walpole's famous favourite places. And as he shows, it is in cemeteries that people have shown most cogently their respect for the landscape and the earth. It is here, even in an age of religious decline and public scepticism, that the sense of the sacred still lingers and extends its protecting hand. The cemetery, the battlefield, and the temple suggest connections between the sacred and the sacrificial, and that is a theme to which I shall return in the last lecture on Thursday. Today I want to explore the emotions and motives that lead us to respect some place as holy and which govern our sense that there are right and wrong ways to treat the earth on which we live and build. It is clear that this theme was fundamental to the Israel of the patriarchs. Their world was very different from ours, far less densely populated, far more dangerous in day-to-day life, and far less subject to abuse. But they, like us, were conscious of the uniqueness of their territory, of the need to respect it and to sanctify it. They regarded the promised land not as a thing to consume and discard, but as an inheritance to be cared for and passed on. And this feeling was bound up for them with two others: their conviction that God was a real presence among them, and their sense of the land as a gift. Not a gift to the present generation to use as it will, but a gift to a people in its entirety and for all time, a resource to be renewed and passed on. And this records a general truth about the sacred. Sacred places are protected from spoliation. They are steeped in the hopes and the sufferings of those who have fought for them, and they belong to others who are yet to be. This, to my way of thinking, is a paradigm of environmental protection, and one that we must again understand if we are to come to grips with what is happening as our world is defaced by the culture of consumption. It is also true that sacred places are the first places to be destroyed by invaders and iconoclasts, for whom nothing is more offensive than the enemy's gods. Hence, we should recognize that much of the destruction of our environment today is deliberate, the result of a willed assault on old and despised forms of tranquility. And there's an example, and it's all coming here soon. Readers of Pausanias, the second century geographer and traveller, will notice that the temples of the gods, The sacred groves and the tombs of heroes were still intact when Pausanias visited them, even though they might have been around for centuries. They're not intact now, as you see, yes, from Agrigento. The sacred places, with their woods and streams, were maintained as public assets by priests and devotees of the old religion in those last years before Christianity swept everything away. Piety forbade their destruction, and it is piety that animated Pausanias in visiting them and recording their charms. This motive is a human universal, and as Simon Sharma has argued in Landscape and Memory, his beautiful tribute to landscape art and to the myths and mysteries of settlement, land and landscape have been portrayed as sacred in all our human attempts to belong to the world, belong in the world. This experience of sanctity is deeply tied to memory. We all carry within us the afterimage of primeval attachment. Memory corrects and straightens our recollections and shapes the remembered oikos or home in terms that are as much imagined as real. We see the process whereby a lost home becomes sacred and purged of all its irritating ordinariness in Mickiewicz's invocation of old Lithuania and Proust's invocation of Cambrai. And we recognise in those literary tours de force a tribute to another relation with the world than the one into which we have been trapped by the habits of consumption. The world described by Proust looks back at him from his own eyes. It is not just a world of objects to be used and discarded. It is a world of revealed meanings in which the most ordinary thing might suddenly blurt out its secrets, or in which a landscape can burst into tears. This returns me to God's encounter with Moses. In addition to the Ten Commandments, God presented the design for a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, as he says. People have been able to reconstruct roughly what the first temple at Jerusalem looked like. The elaborate instructions fix the architecture and the ritual of the temple. And it is around this temple that the city of Jerusalem was built. The shining city on the hill that is the sacred place to which God's people turn from their tribulations. By the time of the Psalms, the sanctity of the temple and that of the city have become one. The true settlement is one in which God dwells among us, and its destruction is an act of sacrilege that changes the face of the world. Surely no one can doubt that the emotion that attaches human subjects to their sacred places is their deepest intimation of what it means to be in the world and in dialogue with it. As the psalmist says, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy." The spoiling of the earth and the vandalizing of our human habitats arouse in us an echo of the desolation that the psalmist records. The desolation that ensues when the spiritual resource on which we depend is driven from its sanctuary and the sanctuary destroyed. Just to remind you of what I'm talking about. And it seems to me that we will not understand what is really at stake in the environmental consciousness that has captured the imagination of so many people today, if we do not recognize a religious memory at the heart of it. God's message concerning the temple was not simply the foundation of a specific cult devoted to the god of a tribe. It was a message to all of us, telling us that God will dwell among us only if we too dwell, and that dwelling does not mean consuming the earth or wasting it, but conserving it so as to make a lasting sanctuary for both God and man. Hence, the promise of God's kingdom in the book of Revelation is a promise of the new Jerusalem, the holy city in which we live side by side and face to face with God. The environmental movement that has come to dominate national and international politics in our time began in Britain as a reaction to the Industrial Revolution, and in America as a lament for the disappearing wilderness. In both places, writers and activists began to portray the earth as a sacred entity, even a quasi-animate being to whom we could relate as pagans related to their gods. John Muir's plea for the Yosemite Valley. Here's a bit of it. Like Ruskin's campaign to save the lakelands of England, was on behalf of a place judged to be both beautiful and sacred, a place whose value could never be captured by the calculus of cost and benefit. John Lovelock's more recent Gaia hypothesis is an attempt to translate that idea into the language of science. From the point of view of philosophy, however, the Gaia hypothesis misses what is really at stake. There is something left out of every scientific account of our relation to our surroundings, and that is the I-to-you encounter and the sense of responsibility that it precipitates. The Earth can be protected only if it can in some way acquire the character of a you, so as to address me eye-to-eye as you do. As a mere it, the Earth and all it contains stands undefended from our predations. Hence, Rilke, in the ninth of the Duino elegies, seeks the subjectivity of the earth and discovers it in us. It is we who have the task of translating into consciousness the things that surround us, and so rescuing them from the world of getting and spending. So he says, Erde, ist es nicht dies, was du willst, unsichtbar in uns erstehen? Earth, isn't this what you want, invisibly to arise in us? Is it not your dream to be someday invisible? Earth, invisible, what, if not transformation, is your insistent demand? Earth, dear one, I will. Oh, believe me, it needs no more of your springtimes to win me over. One, just one, is already too much for my blood. Now, what good, you ask, does it do to our poor earth that we can render it invisible by dissolving it, so to speak, in the first-person perspective? Rilke is attempting to reconsecrate the earth without the help of any god. The poet repudiated every kind of transcendental faith and believed that there is no afterlife, but only this one life on earth which we can waste or fulfill as we choose. But he also believed that life is sacred, as are all the beings that we encounter in the course of it. Rilke's purpose in the Duino elegies was to draw on the raw material from which every experience of the sacred is derived, namely the first-person experience of embodiment, and to use it to build a path away from nihilism. The earth is not just a heap of objects. It has its own subjectivity, and it achieves this subjectivity in me. I want to persuade you that the concept of the sacred is as necessary to us today as it has been to people throughout history. I believe the concept to be both objectively grounded and a resource on which we can draw in our attempts to ring-fence fragile things against destruction. I also believe that it is not the only resource. Aesthetic judgment and the experience of beauty work in the same direction. And it is by understanding the connection between the sacred and the beautiful that we will come, I believe, to a proper interpretation of them both. It is surely clear that the concerns expressed by environmentalists have arisen largely in opposition to the habit of seeing all value in instrumental terms. People have treated the earth and their surroundings as things to be used, and when their use is exhausted, to be thrown away. Thereafter to be washed into one of those sinks, like the oceans and the atmosphere, which we have no need to clean. Suddenly, mankind has awoken to the fact that sinks are finite, that our waste accumulates forever, and that the oceans and the atmosphere have had enough of us. A platform of plastic waste, twice the size of Texas, now swirls in the Pacific Ocean. There's a grim picture of it. Carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere, raising the temperature of the earth and threatening everything that we know and need. And all around us, we see the residue of our self-centeredness, as in the words of William Empson, slowly the poison the whole bloodstream fills. It is the waste remains and kills. When governments address the problem, however, they immediately begin to construe it in fiscal terms, considering the economic costs of our negligence and the economic costs of repairing it. The British government commissioned a report from Sir Nicholas Stern to consider the economic costs of climate change and the policies needed to correct it. And this report has served as the basis for almost all the arguments in the political arena ever since, so making it seem as though the Earth and our environment are to be assessed purely in instrumental terms and without any consideration for their intrinsic value. This triumph of instrumental reasoning, which replaces things with a value by things with a price, is perhaps inevitable, but it is also one of the features of the modern world against which the environmentalists are in rebellion. The environmental problem arises because we have treated the earth as an object and an instrument, in something like the way that we have treated the human being as an object and an instrument. And surely it is not unrealistic to connect the two developments. Our materialist society sees everything, ourselves included, as a thing to be used and consumed. It deals with the world by pricing it. Things that are valued only for their use can be compared with, exchanged against, and sold for other things of the same kind. They can be consumed, depleted, and thrown away by the person who nevertheless acknowledges the only value that they have, which is the cost of a replacement. That is what we now do to each other. It is what we are doing to the earth. The sense of the sacred puts a brake upon that instrumentalizing attitude. There is a primordial intuition here which is not unlike the intuition presented by the human face, as I discussed it last time. Before a sacred place or artifact, I feel respect. This bit of the world, I believe, is inviolable. I could damage it, and maybe I won't be punished for doing so, but it itself speaks to me and tells me to stay my hand. Just as the subject appears in the human face and lays before the assassin and the abuser the absolute no, so does an observing, questing, interrogating I appear in the sacred place and command us to withhold our spoliation. A sceptic will say that that is just figurative talk, an expression of subjective emotions that have no objective correlate in the objects into which we project them. It is our way of treating places and artifacts that makes them sacred, and our decision to do so is invariably rescinded in time. Whether that response is right is a question to which I shall return in the final lecture. But two points need to be immediately made in opposition to it. The first is that the experience of the sacred is interpersonal. Only a creature with eye thoughts can see the world in this way. And his doing so depends upon a kind of interpersonal readiness, a willingness to find meanings and reasons, even in things that have no eyes to look at him and no mouths to speak. The anthropologist might say that the experience of the sacred is a residue of primitive animism. I would counter by saying that animism is not a primitive thing, but a legitimate extension of our sense of our accountability towards others and the world. The second point is that the experience of sacred things is one special case of a more general capacity to find meaning and moral refreshment in the things of this world. Creatures with eye thoughts have a relation to their surroundings that is unlike that of an animal to its habitat. The question, "Why am I here?" which is a constant refrain in the life of the rational being, flips into the question, "Why is here here?" In other words, what is the significance for me that this thing, this place, this Umwelt that I confront is the thing that I confront? Gertrude Stein's dismissal of small-town America with the statement that there is no there there showed, I believe, a true insight into our relation with the earth. Sometimes there is nothing there, and sometimes we make that nothingness by defacing the world, as in the junk city, left in its wake by the motor car. Contrast that, which you're all familiar with if you've been to America, with this. Why is this not junk? It's just as jumbled up, and just as many things competing for our attention, but if you look at the details, you see that what Wallace Stevens called the blessed rage for order manifests in every little part of the canal. We are in philosophical territory that was first mapped out by Kant in the third critique, the critique of judgment. The topic of the first part of that book is the judgment of beauty, a judgment that we all make and which we need to make, Kant believed, if we are to achieve a full understanding of the world and of our own rational capacities. Beauty resides in appearances, but appearances are also realities and things that we share. Our interest in appearances stems from our desire to be at home in our surroundings and to find inscribed in the world of objects some record of our personal concerns. Oscar Wilde remarked that it is only a shallow person who does not judge by appearances. I would add that judging by appearances is what makes persons possible. It is in the world of appearances that we become what we truly are. And one proof of this is the human face, the place in which the human subject comes into view and readies itself for the other. The Critique of Pure Reason established that appearances are not the passively received impressions of the empiricist myth, but the products of a profound interaction between subject and object, by which we impose form and order on the impressions received through our senses. In our everyday interaction with the world, the objects of experience come before us as to be known or to be used. But there is another posture open to us, in which appearances are ordered as objects to be contemplated. In the experience of the beautiful, we take the world into consciousness and let it float there. We savour it as something given and not just as something received. This is not like the savouring of a taste or a smell. It involves reflective study of meanings and an attempt to find the human significance of things that appear. It leads of its own accord to a critical attitude and to reason-governed choices. I measure the object observed against the subject observing it and put both in question, as when I attend a drama and assess my own life in terms of the action on stage, or as when I sit in a tranquil landscape and allow the impression to seep through my feelings and to become part of me. In aesthetic attention, I am enjoying objects for their own sake, and even if their utility is part of what they mean to me, as when I admire a fine building or a beautiful ploughshare, it is not by using them that I appreciate their aesthetic value. How exactly to express the point is one of the deep and difficult questions of philosophy. Let us simply say that aesthetic values are intrinsic values, and that when I find beauty in some object, it is because I am seeing it as an end in itself, and not only as a means to some purpose. And that, of course, is how I see persons when they stand before me face to face, and I recognise that I am accountable to them and they to me. In the aesthetic experience, we have something like a face-to-face encounter with the world itself and with all that it contains. It does not follow from this that aesthetic values are useless. On the contrary, it is the intrinsic value of beautiful things that renders them useful. Although, by definition, intrinsic values cannot be translated into utilitarian values, this does not mean that they are useless. Consider friendship. Your friend is valuable to you as the thing that he is. To treat him as a means, to use him for your purposes, is to undo the friendship. And yet friends are useful. They provide help in times of need, and they amplify the joys of daily living. Friendship is supremely useful, so long as we do not think of it as useful. Likewise with the environment. It is not that the economists are wrong to think that the environment is useful to us, or that the costs and benefits can be calculated and weighed in the balance. It is that the most important benefits come to us only when we do not weigh them in the balance. We gain the benefits of the earth when we cease to aim for them. And that is the role of beauty, which comes before the vandal and the abuser, as the face of the victim before the would-be assassin. It utters a quiet but absolute no that can be overridden by violence, but not removed by calculation. And this no is received as a face-to-face challenge, as though the object were speaking to the spectator, I to you. The monk who burned down the famous temple at Kyoto, the greatest treasure of Japanese architecture, said that he set fire to it because it was so beautiful, and its beauty was a judgment against himself. Surely an interpersonal response, if ever there was one. This leads me to a very important observation, which is that beauty can be defaced, and where there is aesthetic value, there is also the possibility of desecration. I discussed the desire to deface in connection with human sexual experience last time. A similar desire is present in our confrontation with our surroundings. Beauty, order, and the home create demands. They are to be respected, and we feel judged by them as we are judged by other subjects. Hence there arises a desire to take revenge, to wipe away the knowing smile with which they look on our imperfections. The beautiful object demands to be contemplated, but not consumed. And in a world of instrumental values, this demand is received as a rebuke. The habit of waste and litter is in part a response to this. Places where order and beauty can enter our world and make a difference, eating for instance, are privatized so as to become me occasions and to lose the aspect of dialogue in which their beauty resides. I want to illustrate this with two aspects of popular culture, both expressing the me attitude and the damage that it wreaks on public space. Graffiti and fast food. We're all familiar with this. Graffiti are acts of aggression against the public realm, ways of defacing it. Often they involve caricatures of writing by people who perhaps have not yet obtained the skill, who are taking their revenge on a skill which, above all others, symbolises the act of interpersonal communication. The graffiti artist is offended by the sight of a settled place, a place that excludes him since he does not and cannot belong. He belongs not to a place, but to the homeless gang that is passing through with threatening gestures. Something similar should be said, I think, about fast food. This may or may not be a medical offence, but it is certainly an aesthetic offence, which does not merely wipe out the place, the meal, in other words, in which aesthetic values enter daily life and determine it, but also leaves a trail of packaging and waste across the surface of the world. It desecrates townscapes and landscapes with childish logos of a kind that reinforce the message that eating is stuffing and that the world is a trough. If you had been looking for a way to deface our world and close up the avenue to meaning, you could hardly have found a better one. But this brings me to another and equally important observation concerning the nature of aesthetic values. The subject of aesthetics took off when Kant and Hume simultaneously recognised, though on very different grounds, that aesthetic enjoyment involves a judgment. It is founded in a sense of the rightness of this object that I enjoy, as it is presented to my attention. When thinking and responding aesthetically, it is rarely beauty that concerns us. Our ordinary aesthetic judgments concern what is right and wrong, what fits and harmonises, what looks as it should. This is very clear in the aesthetics of everyday life. When dressing for a party, laying a table, decorating a room and so on, are all aimed at the right appearance, and the pleasure taken is inseparable from the judgment that the thing looks as it should. Here is a little example. Notice the expression of aesthetic concentration on the face of the two children as they're trying to get it right. There is an internal relation here between preference and judgment. Hence, whether we like it or not, and most people don't like it, we become answerable to other rational beings for our tastes. Through our aesthetic choices, we are creating presences in the world of others. And what they think of the result is part of how it matters both to them and to us. This is not to say that we can find reasons for our choices, still less that we can find justifying reasons. But we are in some sense committed to the existence of those reasons. And the art of criticism consists in discovering paths to them. Neither Kant nor Hume came up with an argument that could really underpin this search for what Hume called the standard of taste, though both had interesting and far-reaching things to say about it. But the phenomenon appears less mysterious, I believe, if we see it as arising from the I-you relationship and from its intrinsic tendency towards accountability. Aesthetic judgment is a fundamental element in the posture described by the German romantics as Heimkehr, the turning for home. The search for beauty is the search for settlement in a place that we share. In designing our surroundings, we are bringing them within the sphere of accountability, our accountability to others and theirs to us. And in that sense, we are providing the world with a face. We deface the world when we scribble me all over it and invite others to do the same. It is for this reason that thinkers and artists of the Enlightenment turned to natural beauty to fill the God-shaped hole in their worldview. The assault on religion had bereaved them, and now they wandered, like Caspar David Friedrich and Friedrich Hölderlin, in search of a home. The Romantic movement was a movement of unsettled souls in search of settlement, and beauty was the tent that sheltered them in their loneliness, the promise of the final homecoming that had once been promised by God. Beauty may seem like the consolation offered to loneliness that has loneliness as its price. In fact, it is a promise of community, even if only an imagined community that has yet to find a place on earth. And there he is busy imagining it. The landscapes admired by the Romantics, here's one, Constable's Cottage in a Cornfield, were the product of human settlement over centuries, continuous with the architecture that embellished them or which stood in them as ruins. Beautiful nature does not occur, it is built as a home. And that was true, too, of the American wilderness that Muir, Thoreau and Emerson wished to protect from human predation. For the Native Americans, the landscape had in fact been managed as a home, whose every contour bore witness to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle that the white man had extinguished. The Romantic poets and painters of the New America were reconfiguring the landscape as wilderness, and their conception of its beauty was the byproduct of another form of settlement than the one they had destroyed. It is not that the Romantics found beauty in nature, it is rather that they created and transfigured nature through the pursuit of beauty. The love of natural beauty leads, therefore, to the attempt to shape our surroundings as a home. We do this by farming, by building, by arranging the world. Aesthetic values govern every form of settlement, and it is the nomads, those passing through, who acknowledge no responsibility for the way things appear around them. It is nomads who acknowledge no responsibility for the way things appear around them. The face of nature, as we see it in the great landscape paintings of Constable and Crome, is a picture by Crome, River Seen at Dusk, is a face turned towards us, giving and receiving smiles. It was the desire to perpetuate this face and to save it from unnecessary blemishes that motivated the environmental movement in Britain during the 19th century. The movement began from aesthetic indignation and led at last to the foundation of the National Trust by Octavia Hill and others in 1895. Miss Hill was a follower of Ruskin, and like him she believed that natural beauty is a commons. By respecting and conserving it, the Ruskinians believed, we maintain the face that forbids the destroyer. Alike aesthetic indignation against fast food and its detritus has launched two of the most significant recent initiatives on behalf of the environment. The movement in defence of the local food culture in France, led by the farmer José Bové, and the slow food movement in Italy, which arose from protests against a proposal to establish a McDonald's in the Piazza di Spagna in Rome. An aesthetic crime, the prospect of which awoke the Roman people to the downside of the global economy Alas, McDonald's did have its way, there it is. But the double yellow arches were minimised in accordance with local planning controls. The conflict over signs, fascias and logos may seem an insignificant skirmish in the environmental conflict, but it illustrates what is actually at stake. The conflict is between instrumental and intrinsic values. While everyone has a right to advertise his wares, the advertisement should not spoil the place on which it shines. And American adverts seem invariably designed to do just that. By drawing attention to themselves, they overwhelm their surroundings. They are a violent appropriation of a common asset. Now, maybe they don't have that effect in America. After all, it is hard to see how the average American Main Street can be spoiled by an illuminated sign or by anything else. This is downtown Detroit. But the main streets of European cities are the result of meticulous aesthetic decisions over centuries in which the details aim to harmonise and nothing willingly obtrudes. Our cities have been, and to a certain extent still are, sacred places whose contours are also the record of a continuous dialogue over centuries between people and buildings. Do we really want the double yellow arches competing with the arches of a classical cortile, or cocking a snook at the Pantheon, which they do, as you see? The conflict here goes deep. Aesthetic revulsion against adverts and logos is not a new thing, nor will it be overcome by habituation. From Vance Packard's Hidden Persuaders to Naomi Klein's No Logo, post-war writers have drawn attention to the fact that we are not just distracted by these things, but invaded by them. They seek possession of the human soul, and they do this by colonizing the human habitat. We experience them as ugly because they are the avatars of the thing that is destroying us, the habit of remaking the world and everything in it as an object of consumption, and a thing to be grabbed by me. The aesthetic attitude is our refuge against consumerism, our way of remaking the world as a sanctuary and the place where we are spiritually at home. It is a prophylactic against the desire to pillage and the environment's greatest friend. In describing the importance of the face in our understanding of persons, I made a reference to the upright posture of the human being, which rescues us from so many of the forms of animal behaviour when eating, conversing, attacking, kissing, and in 100 other ways. When creating a settlement, we try to immortalise this posture, to spread it around us so that buildings can converse with those who pass them by. This, I believe, is the spiritual foundation of classicism in architecture. God's instructions to Moses were that he build a temple, a sacred house in a sacred place. And this temple was to be organised around its pillars. It is not too fanciful, I believe, to connect the pillars of the temple with the classical orders. I think I've got an illustration of this. The column-based rules for organising the outward aspect of buildings, which provided the core discipline of city architecture in the Western tradition from antiquity until the eve of the First World War, in other words, from the birth of our civilization to its suicide. The classical orders were originally employed in the construction of temples. Cities are sacred places and must begin from an act of consecration. Consecration is something we do, presenting something new for divine endorsement. It is the theme of all those rites of passage whereby communities renew themselves. And it is the beginning of any building that is to be permanent, any building in which settlement is the goal. The secret of the classical tradition is that it takes the act of consecration and generalizes it. The upright posture of the column in which the building stands before me, I to you, is endowed with a face by the division into sections and the elaboration of mouldings and transitions. Our ability to endow buildings with faces is like our ability to see character in a theatrical mask. By facing a building, we conjure a face in it, and by silently addressing the building, we allow it to address us in its turn. In the classical order, the face is transfigured to become a rule of harmony. The vertical arrangement creates boundaries and shadows, which can be spread sideways through a facade so as to give a continuous posture to a building. Thus, the column can be repeated to make a terrace that stands upright before the passerby, even though stretching horizontally for hundreds of yards. This, of course, is Bath, but you see the order is explicit in one part and only implicit elsewhere. But it's there as a presence before you. The pattern book architecture, which created the great Victorian cities in Britain and its empire, and also in the United States, was derived from the principles of the classical tradition and handed down to the ordinary builder and planner in the form of ready-made details, such as those used in building this street in the English fishing town of Whitby. This is not beautiful, nor does it try to be. On the other hand, it is guided at every point by aesthetic values, and the houses stand side by side as companions, addressing the street from windows that smile and doorways that welcome. Notice the street lamp, not a temporary structure, but a permanent fixture, itself a byproduct of the classical idiom and held aloft as though by a hand. You still have examples of this in St. Andrews. This too respects the human posture, and every modest house in this humble street stands before us with a face. One of the most significant developments in recent architecture has been the removal of both the facade and the upright posture. In the early years of the skyscraper, tall buildings were conceived like the Chrysler Building in New York as exultant fingers pointing to the sky. Now they are conceived as stacks of horizontal layers, piled one on the other and requiring no design other than the ground plan. Here you see a chunk of Mies van der Rohe's much-admired Seagram building of 1958. It's the central, the big one in that mess. Indistinguishable from 1,000 steel and glass office blocks since constructed, incapable of housing anything but offices, and setting a pattern that has been followed all around the world and which requires nothing from the architect besides a ground plan. This is the triumph of the horizontal, and the resulting building can be as tall as you like, as tall as the Seagram building, but it will never have a vertical posture and never meet you face to face. This is the final desacralisation of architecture, its removal from the realm of sacred things. In such a building, boundaries and units of significance are muted or absent. There are no windows, no decorated corners, no places from which the building looks out at passers-by. It is a sealed box with translucent walls made of dark glass and bronze in alternating strips. It reminds you of those people who appear in company wearing dark glasses, behind which you are forced to think is a self-satisfied, insolent stare. Such people mask themselves as objects, lest the subject should appear and be judged. The Seagram building exists on a constant diet of energy, to heat it in winter and to cool it in summer. Moreover, since it is sealed from the outer air, it requires yet more energy to circulate air around its interior, and that air gradually becomes home to the many diseases that are brought in by the workforce, so that the building itself becomes sick. This too is an ecological cost. Yet the Seagram building set the pattern for the next 50 years, without the bronze and with a steel frame and curtain wall of glass or concrete panels. It is the existence of this style of architecture, more than any other cause, that has led to the desertification of downtown America. Such buildings can house offices, but they are uncomfortable and alienating as apartments, and seldom change over to domestic use. Moreover, they vandalise the street in which they stand, casting it in day-long shadow. Here's an interesting contrast from a new development in Bristol, England. On the right side of the road, you see rebuilt Georgian houses, which follow the line of the street in a genial way, using the standard pattern book vocabulary that we saw in Whitby. They have housed offices, apartments, and a school, and could be adapted to any use since they obey shared aesthetic constraints that give rise to a strong desire to live or work in them. On the left, you see a brutal backside to a shopping precinct with offices above. Notice that there are no divisions of a recognisable kind. Windows there are, but only of the kind that cannot be opened. The building does not know how to meet the street and stands helplessly above the pavement with no apertures through which human life could pass. Two things stand out here. This is a building that is not going to change its function, however long it stands, and nobody is going to hang around this place at night. It is a de-urbanising building, one that is in the business of chasing people to the suburbs. The windows of modern downtown buildings are not eyes. They do not humanise the facade. They suggest no form or pattern that could be repeated and lay no constraints on what can and cannot be placed beside, above and beneath them. The result is not just an aesthetic disaster, it is an ecological disaster too. And it exemplifies an important feature of the modern world, which is the hard work that is being constantly expended on losing knowledge. The modernist vernacular, which conceives buildings as curtains of tinted glass raised on invisible scaffolds of concrete and steel, represents both an unusual advance for ignorance and a giant ecological threat. And architects and their theorists devoted an immense amount of intellectual labour to achieving this result. More recent developments involve an assault not only on the facade, but on the whole idea of public space. Postmodernist buildings are designed, like this one, as gadgets, so-called objects, as Leon Krier calls them, like this magnified kitchen appliance from Lower Manhattan. The effect of this on the street is catastrophic. Compare it with the dignified building to the left of it. But notice too the somewhat similar or at least equally offensive building which stands arbitrarily behind it, creating the effect of two bits of junk on a garbage heap. To clean the windows of this building, as you see, you need to block the road with a boom lift. And because it looks like junk, it soon will be junk, as the cost of maintenance outstrips the cost of pulling it down and starting again. This kind of gadget architecture is springing up all over our world. You have an eloquent example in the Scottish Parliament, built at phenomenal cost and without any sense of what public architecture really means. New buildings are without faces and show the triumph of utility, their gadget character being an attempt to borrow the aesthetic of the domestic utensil. Their effect is to remake the exterior space of the city as a place of discarded interiors, of household junk thrown out in the street. This is the me feeling without the I that offers an account or the you that receives it. Such buildings cannot fit into the street or stand happily next to other buildings for the simple reason that they do not stand at all. They are designed as waste, throwaway architecture involving vast quantities of energy-intensive materials which will be demolished within 20 years. Townscapes built from such architecture resemble landfill sites, scattered heaps of plastic junk from which the eye and the soul turn away in dejection. Now what I am referring to here is the equivalent in architectural practice of the cancelling of the human face that I commented on last time. Gadget architecture neither stands nor looks. It is dropped in the townscape like litter, and neither faces the passerby nor includes him. It may offer shelter, but cannot make a home. And by becoming habituated to it, we lose one fundamental component in our respect for the earth. The gadget building is also a consumer product. It is to be thrown away once used and retains its appearance of stagnant impermanence, like rubbish that no one has the responsibility to clear. In this, it contributes to the widespread cancellation and desecration of the public sphere. Squares and streets are ceasing to be places in which we walk and converse. Instead, they are places that we hurry through on our way to a home that we may never find. I'll give you another example, which is the Box Center at Tulsa, Oklahoma, which vividly illustrates the de-urbanizing nature of gadget architecture. The gadget requires a vast clearing around itself. It cannot stand next to anything. The whole idea of next is cancelled by its unmatchable forms. It is an assault on the very principle of neighborhood, and its facelessness is a denial of neighbor love. What all such examples show, however, is that environmental degradation comes in just the same way that moral degradation comes, through defacing things, representing people and places in impersonal ways, as objects to be used rather than as subjects to be respected. But, you will say, the environment is only an object or a collection of objects. It is at best a metaphor, at worst a superstition, to think that there is a spirit in the things around us which we might address and from which we might take consolation as we address and are consoled by each other. Of course, poets and painters have presented nature in this way, in the manner of Wordsworth and Samuel Palmer, whom you see there. But for us, this is only a manner of speaking or of seeing, a way of underlining our emotional proximity to and dependence on the things around us. Even Rilke's passionate address to the earth as Du Lieber is no more than an offer of subjectivity, a promise to dissolve the earth in the eye of the poet. In itself, the earth rolls round in its diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. Or is it so simple? The sense of beauty puts a brake upon destruction by representing its object as irreplaceable. When the world looks back at me with my eyes, as it does in aesthetic experience, it is also addressing me in another way. Something is being revealed to me, and I am being made to stand still and absorb it. It is, of course, nonsense to suggest that there are naiads in the trees and dryads in the groves who are whispering to me. What is revealed to me in the experience of beauty is a fundamental truth about being, the truth that being is a gift and receiving it is a task. This is a truth of theology that demands exposition as such. Hence, my exploration of the face of the earth leads to the real topic of these lectures, which is the face of God.
Very much indeed. Well, we have, as on previous occasions, some time for question and answer, so who would like to kick off?
Looks like I've shut them up this time.
No. Yes, William.
What are your responsibilities to provide a home for animals? And in which case, which animals? And how do we judge which animals we should be preserving?
That's a very good question. One would like to think that we have a responsibility to leave a habitat for animals. If we start actually deciding which animals should be in the habitat, then we're exerting probably more control than we should be. The whole our relation to the animal world, if it's to be a healthy one, I think, depends upon a sense that the animal world is not simply a zoo that we keep for our own enlightenment and interest, and shouldn't be just a collection of pets. There should be the ability of animals to make their own way and form their own kind of interspecies equilibrium. But at least that's the way I look at it. That is what a true respect for their way of life would involve. Obviously, it's difficult to do that when we occupy every single corner of the earth. But one of the motives behind the national park movement in America, that initiated by John Muir and with the Yosemite National Park, was to maintain habitats in which animals would be themselves. Unfortunately, animals have territories which are bigger than national parks. This means that they generate population imbalances which require people to come along and cull the excesses of deer or do what they can to help the bears, etc. Even in national parks, the whole population gets managed. But let it be said that The worst thing that we do is keeping pets, in my view, especially cats. 9 million of them in this country, which kill 190 million innocent animals every year, and they're essentially eliminating from the countryside all other forms of life. But it's very difficult to put that point across to people. Another.
At times, and I could be wrong, but at times you seem to imply a relationship between ritual and the sacred, and then again between ritual and recognition of something of intrinsic value in you. I was wondering if I was right in making this inference, and if you could expound upon those relationships.
Yeah, well, this is, you're absolutely right. This is the topic which I want to get on to next time, one of the topics, which is the place of ritual in focusing our conception of the sacred and, as it were, making times and places speak properly to us of their transcendental meaning. And obviously, all rites of passage that have been studied by anthropologists have a ritualized component, and that ritual is bound up with the act of consecration. You consecrate a marriage through ritual. You consecrate a baby through baptism and other ritual things like that. And I think understanding ritual is the most important feature of any true theology. And it is what in God's original instructions to Moses, it wasn't just about building the temple. It was about the rituals that are performed there by way of representing him as both present and absent. That's the crucial thing that had to be understood.
Jim?
Yes, I want to challenge you on your statement about pets. I want to make a small point in order to make a larger one. Mm. The pets that we keep have a vastly superior quality of life than the animals that live in nature. And the solution to the problem of cats is perfectly simple. You tell people to keep their cats indoors. Cats are quite happy living indoors, except they can't kill things. Now, the larger point I want to make is that while I'm certainly sympathetic to what you're saying about gadget architecture and to some degree about modern architecture, I think there's another side that your presentation is imbalanced, because you're romanticizing nature. And the fact is that the natural state is a horrible state to live in, for human beings and for animals. And the romanticizing pictures that you show there of architecture in good old days for people who had shorter, less happy lives, poorer nutrition, so on and so on. So there has to be a balance struck somewhere between some of the difficulties with the aesthetics of the natural, of the modern world, and the perhaps better aesthetics of a much technologically poorer world.
Yes, well, these are both very useful points, and I'm not unsympathetic to what you say about the state in which the superior life that pets have over their wild equivalent. But nevertheless, it doesn't alter the fact that wild animals are at risk from pets. And it's only because cats are so small that they can be kept as pets indoors. I don't myself think that they're particularly happy in that condition. I think they're much, in my observation, they're much happier outside killing mice and birds. But you may be right. But for lions cannot be kept in that way without considerable suffering. It has the advantage, of course, that every now and then they kill their owners. That obviously makes a contribution to better ecological management.
Is there a problem with people keeping lions as pets?
Well, it's a problem for the lions.
It's a problem we need to worry about.
No, not at the moment. But you know, were we to take full command of the animal kingdom and offer the luxury of a pet's life to all the species that we adore, then of course we would have to make the sacrifices required to keep lions indoors. And as I say, it might have a useful spin-off of the human population problem. And that's another thing to be said about your what you were saying about those old disease-ridden forms of architecture and lifestyle that represented by the canals in Venice. It's true that life was harder then and that people died young. There isn't a great deal of evidence from literature that they were less happy. There aren't many smiles in modern literature. There's an awful lot of smiles in Venetian literature of the 17th and 18th century. And indeed, it's famous it's famous for painting those smiles and presenting to us an image of human beings in a state of exhilaration from morn till night. People lived less long, but they lived too long now. So, you know, it's not from the ecological point of view, there's nothing to be complained about that they all popped off in their 30s and 40s. The question is, in all these things, how do we balance values against each other? We appreciate longevity, we appreciate modern medicine, we appreciate the diet we have now. We lament also the waste that is building up in our wake. We lament what we're doing to the earth. How do we balance these things against each other? I'm not saying that you can't achieve a balance, but I am saying that if you don't put aesthetic values at the centre of things, you will never get to that balance. You may be right that my examples are a little bit skewed. A really subtle course on what architectural aesthetics should embrace, which obviously couldn't be done in half an hour. But I was using the classical idiom as a way of showing what building a home is really like, building a collective home is really like. And that should operate as an example for us, even though, things have changed.
Question here.
Yeah, just a brief historical question. You mentioned the First World War as a high point or key point in the tale of moral aesthetic degradation. Are you saying that part of your thesis that the battle was lost essentially in the 19th century? Because the sort of bogeyman throughout your lectures has been the rise of utilitarianism, and also what you're saying about aesthetics and architecture, it reminds me a lot of Pugin's lament of the neoclassicist revival and sort of the failure to recognise the organic nature of building and the community and that sort of thing. So is the 19th century where this.
It's a very. Good point that obviously there is a kind of historical undercurrent to what I've been saying, and I'm not sure how to give a history of the environmental movement in general, but it certainly began in Britain in the early 19th century, and when it came to in the case of towns, it was Pugin and Ruskin who began it. And they began it because they were wanting to maintain the old organic sense of the city as a sacred place in which things harmonized at every level. And utilitarianism might be regarded as one of the things that people thought of as threatening, but far more threatening was the Industrial Revolution itself and the fact that new forms of new building materials, new forms of ownership and so on had come into being, which enabled people to clear away whole areas of towns and put in the place of a proper habitation some monstrous factory. So I think that there was all kinds of currents in the culture which helped to further people's consciousness of what was of the degradation of cities in the 19th century and, of course, of the degradation of the landscape. In Britain, the things that really precipitated it were the destruction of Epping Forest, no, Hainault Forest, rather, in adjacent to London, when it was sold off by the government, it ceased to be common land, it's something like 1851, and also the building of the railways through the Lake District. Those two things really agitated people, and thereafter, it became one of the major civic movements, culminating, as I said, in 1895 with the foundation of the National Trust.
Time perhaps one more quick question, if someone has one. Yes, please.
When you talk about God, the word God, you talk about this word in a more religious sense or in a more philosophical sense. Do you have an ontological proof for this word? And what is the link between this word God and the word sacred?
Well, this is the topic of next time, but I would say that I began in the first lecture giving not an ontological proof, but a cosmological proof for the existence of God, one which I don't think is valid, but is pointing in the right direction. That's Avicenna's proof from contingent being. But what I said then was that this does produce a cogent concept of God, but the problem then is that it creates a question about his relation to us. How is he revealed in this world? And I'm trying to say that is a general question, not only about God, but also about us, and that we come to an understanding of it as we come to understand the idea of the sacred, and that our ability to treat objects, places, times, and objects as sacred has everything to do with our ability to confront God face to face. But that's what I want to say next time.
That seems like a good point at which to pause. I'm reluctant to use a phrase which, for all sorts of reasons, to use a phrase which I believe is drawn from the marketing industry of all places, and that's the phrase deferred gratification. But if it can be redeemed, then I suspect it might be in the way by saying that while we've had all sorts of realised gratification thus far, nevertheless we do look forward with great anticipation to what is yet to come in the final lecture. Will you please thank Professor Scruton with